First of all, I want to apologize for not being here last week, but it was very embarrassing. Or I slipped in a buddy's driveway and initially put out my back and twisted my foot, and I just was just dreading the idea of making my way through all of that snow and trying to get here and then standing on a gimpy foot. It would have been a very strange thing under the influence of pain relievers. So thanks for being patient, and I understand you had a great discussion last week without me being here, and the fact that I wasn't here probably helped you have a great discussion, so glad to see you. So I originally planned to combine my final week and my third week together in one piece, but the tone of them are just so different. It just felt very incongruous. So what I'm going to do with your, hopefully you guys will bear with me, I will send the final discussion that I would have done today to Ted to distribute to you folks or anyone who's interested via email. And so, yes. If with your indulgence, I will actually deliver what I should have delivered last week today. Ted is handing out the only audiovisual component of this. If I were like some of the whippersnappers at the Post-Gazette these days, I would have, my computer here, and I would be doing all sorts of audiovisual tricks, but I just don't have the patience or the sophistication for that, so I use an old-fashioned Xerox machine. In fact, my internet went out yesterday, so I couldn't even make color copies of these, of this painting. But you'll get the idea. Like, if you don't have enough of them, you can like share, look over your neighbor's shoulder and so forth. Because I'm only going to spend a minute on this particular painting by John McNaughton, probably a name that some of you are probably familiar with. He's been described as the Tea Party's answer to Norman Rockwell. So without further ado, this is the discussion about American exceptionalism. This has been an extraordinary week for American exceptionalism. On Wednesday, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani said, "I do not believe, and I know it is a horrible thing to say, but I do not believe that the president loves America. He doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me. He wasn't brought up the way you and I were brought up, and I was brought up through love of this country." "With all our flaws," Giuliani continued, "we're the most exceptional country in the world. I'm looking for a presidential candidate who can express that, do that, and carry it out." Asked to elaborate on his comments later in the evening, Giuliani said, "What country has left so many young men and women dead abroad to save other countries without taking land? This is not the colonial empire that someone has in his hand," he said, referring to President Obama. "I've never felt that from him. I felt that from George W. Bush. I felt that from Bill Clinton. I felt that from every American president, including the ones I disagree with, including Jimmy Carter. I don't feel that from President Obama." Giuliani's comments were made in response to President Obama's prayer breakfast earlier in the month that caused heads to explode all over Washington because it was deemed insufficiently patriotic and even anti-Christian. These are the words that triggered Giuliani's wrath. This is what President Obama said. "From a school in Pakistan to the streets of Paris, we have seen violence and terror perpetrated by those who profess and stand up for their faith, profess to stand up for Islam, but in fact are betraying it. We see ISIL, a vicious death cult that, in the name of religion, carries out unspeakable acts of barbarism, terrorizing religious minorities, subjecting women to rape as a weapon of war, and claiming the mantle of religious authority for such actions. We see sectarian war in Syria, the murder of Muslims and Christians in Nigeria, religious war in the Central African Republic, a rising tide of anti-Semitism and hate crimes in Europe, so often perpetrated in the name of religion. So how do we, as people of faith, reconcile these realities, the profound good, the strength, the tenacity, the compassion and love that flow from all our faiths, operating alongside those who seek to hijack religions for their own murderous ends? The quote continues from President Obama. Humanity has been grappling with these questions throughout human history. Unless we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ. So this is not unique to one group or one religion. There is a tendency in us, a sinful tendency, that can pervert and distort our faith. In today's world, when hate groups have their own Twitter accounts and bigotry can fester in hidden places in cyberspace, it can be even harder to counteract such intolerance. But, and this is the president still speaking, but God compels us to try. And in this mission, I believe there are a few principles that can guide us, particularly those of us who profess to believe. And first, we should start with some basic humility. I believe that the starting point of faith is some doubt, not being so full of yourself and so confident that you are right and that God speaks only to us and doesn't speak to others. And God only cares about us and doesn't care about others. That somehow we alone are in possession of truth. Our job is not to ask that God respond to our notion of truth. Our job is to be true to Him, His word, and His commandments. And we should assume humbly that we're confused and don't always know what we're doing, and we're staggering and stumbling towards Him, and have some humility in the process. And that means we have to speak up against those who would misuse His name to justify oppression or violence or hatred with that fierce certainty. No God condones terror. No grievance justifies the taking of innocent lives or the oppression of those who are weaker or fewer in numbers. Now, these are the words that have generated so much grief for the President of the United States. In the months since he uttered those words, more than a few pundits have observed that though he's clearly capable of handling the rhetoric of faith, he doesn't come across as someone who truly believes in American exceptionalism, the civil religion that provides spiritual oxygen to the scoundrels who dominate our politics. And they're right. Though few presidents have been as explicit about their faith as the current occupant of the White House, President Obama doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, and neither should you. There's a painting by John McNaughton that nicely sums up the theology of people like Giuliani and many of those who give more credence to American exceptionalism than the gospel. It is called One Nation Under God, and that's what Ted was handing out. And it is an aesthetic and theological abomination. It features, and I know it's sort of blurry, and I apologize again for the reproduction. It features a halo-illuminated Jesus Christ standing in the center, presenting what is presumably the original U.S. Constitution to the world, while flanked by the founding fathers, a kneeling Abe Lincoln, Ronald Reagan, and soldiers from various eras. The Capitol, a flag, and a Supreme Court building are in the background, a strong indication that it is Judgment Day in Washington. To Jesus' right is a little boy who points to the Constitution newly minted in heaven. The other people in the foreground on Jesus' right are ordinary Americans, a Marine, a woman with a baby, even a black guy holding a book called The 5,000 Year Leap, a book Glenn Beck swears by. To Jesus' left are people who are supposed to represent the secular elite. There's a robed Supreme Court justice with his face planted in his hands as if ashamed of every decision he ever made. His papers are scattered beneath Jesus' feet on the stage steps. There's a pregnant lady standing next to the justice who appears clueless to what's happening. So McNaughton isn't going for subtlety here. Another guy, presumably a businessman on his cell phone, has his back turned to Jesus. A female reporter with a microphone is trying to get the scoop on Jesus. All of the people on Jesus' left are distracted in some way. If you look carefully, and you guys can't see this because of the reproduction, you can see Satan as a hooded apparition crouching behind the people on the left. These are clearly the goats that Jesus will banish to perdition as soon as the holy ink has dried on the Constitution. McNaughton is a painter of modest technical skill who has turned his lack of imagination into a lucrative gig producing religious-inspired patriotic kitsch. But as awful as his paintings are, they accurately combine the elements of American exceptionalism with Christian triumphalism. He has put his finger on a particularly toxic mix of religious chauvinism and nationalism that has taken up residence in too many American churches. He knows his audience, and he knows that it is gullible and biblically illiterate. So why have so many of our fellow American Christians bought into such an obvious con job? Why do American Christians give even a scintilla of credence to the notion that God plays favorites with nations, and that America has been God's particular favorite for the last 239 years? Why do so many of us take umbrage at the notion that the nation's founders weren't divinely inspired, and at the end of the day were at best a talented group of merchants, farmers, businessmen, revolutionaries, and free thinkers inspired more by Enlightenment ideas, inspired more by the Enlightenment ideas that swirled around the 18th century than a messianic calling to build a Christian nation? Do we feel ourselves getting dry in the mouth at the possibility that our country isn't any more special than ancient Rome was under the Caesars, or Babylon under its mad kings, or contemporary Sweden with its beautiful people and high suicide rate? What would it mean for us if our own historic blessings, as we've interpreted them, have more to do with ruthlessness on our part in acquiring them than God's providential intercession on our behalf? I suppose I get the attraction to this nonsense, the myth of American exceptionalism flatters us. When we look around at this nation's bounty of natural resources, its skilled labor force, its entrepreneurial energy and resourcefulness, its technological prowess, its economic dominance and military superiority, it's difficult not to believe we haven't been singled out for an extra helping of blessings. Surely some god or some genie in a lamp has been looking out for us, we tell ourselves. After all, we're not suffering under authoritarian rule like so many others in this world. We may stand with despots in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, but we're not living under them. We have a constitution that explicitly guarantees our rights to worship as we see fit. We also have the right to bear arms and resist government tyranny. We have freedom of speech and assembly. There's no official state church, but Protestant Christianity comes closer than any other ideology to being our state religion. We call ourselves a Judeo-Christian nation with an emphasis on Christian. That's because most of the founding fathers were nominally Christian, though most were deists or free thinkers in practice. That inconvenient fact is glossed over along with all the unchristian policies, practices, wars, thefts, massacres, and stolen labor that got us here. And if you're silly enough to believe Jesus Christ himself wasn't present during the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the crafting and ratification of the Constitution, you're obliged to believe this obvious fact. He imbued those men, the landed gentry who rebelled against English colonial rule, with a spirit of wisdom that has trickled down through the ages. How else does one explain all of these blessings? When in doubt, we can always defer to the wisdom of the founders because they were Jesus' representatives on earth, right? That's what our founding myths tell us in no uncertain terms. Christians and non-Christians in this country unconsciously rebrand the founders as men of faith and substance who believed in the idea of America as we understand it now. They believed in the almighty currency that is made in their image, and they believed in America's exceptional role in the world, even before it became America. The founders were spiritual heirs of John Winthrop, the governor of Massachusetts, best known for his famous city on a hill metaphor that explicitly compared his constituents in New England to God's chosen people entering the promised land in the Old Testament. A few weeks ago, I made reference to the fact that Martin Luther King used this promised land rhetoric in his final sermon to refer to a post-racial America he believed was on the horizon. As early as 1630, John Winthrop was already defining American identity as religious and separate from European influence. And this is a quote from Winthrop. "Consider that we shall be as a city on a hill, the eyes of all people upon us," he wrote. And Winthrop assured those New England Puritans that God will bless them to the extent that they obeyed him, that they obeyed God. He also promised that God would toss them out of the promised land he was preparing for them if they deviated from his ways. And from the beginning, a minority of Americans were trained to believe that they had the inside track with God. And of course, Winthrop appropriated the city on a hill metaphor from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, a virtual catalog of Scripture's most stirring images. It was a metaphor that was picked up by JFK and Ronald Reagan, both of whom used it to reinforce the idea of American exceptionalism. Reagan added shining to the description of the city on a hill, giving it a contemporary feel that immediately resonated. Even President Obama, the one man that so many American Christians associate with the Antichrist, appropriated the term for his own ends to the irritation of much of his political base. And during a press conference in France in 2009, the president said the following. And this is Obama. This is Obama speaking. "I believe in American exceptionalism." But here's the twist. "Just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism, I am enormously proud of my country and its role and history in the world. If you think about the site of this summit," this was taking place in France, "and what it means, I don't think America should be embarrassed to see evidence of the sacrifices of our troops, the enormous amount of resources that were put into Europe post-war, and our leadership in crafting an alliance that ultimately led to the unification of Europe. We should take great pride in that, and if you think of our current situation, the United States remains the largest economy in the world. We have unmatched military capability, and I think that we have a core set of values that are enshrined in our Constitution, in our body of law, in our democratic practices, in our belief in free speech and equality, though imperfect, are exceptional." That's the president speaking in 2009. This is the same man that many people in the last week have questioned whether he believes in this country or loves this country. It's astonishing. Those words sound like the words of someone who is enormously proud of his country. In fact, a Google search will confirm that no previous president has talked about America's exceptional place in the world more than this president. The problem with this Christian president, whom many Christians continue to believe is a Muslim in disguise, is that he refuses to use the term as a code for full-throated patriotism blessed by God. He qualifies the term whenever he uses it by saying that every nation believes it is exceptional in its own way. To people like Giuliani, this sounds like treason. Yes, in many ways, this is an echo of the latest controversy swirling around the president because of his administration's reluctance to use the term Islamic extremism when referring to ISIL. Because Obama is someone who was very aware of the meaning of words, he can be careful to a fault sometimes when it comes to parsing nuance at the expense of the overall message. Subscribing to the cult of American exceptionalism is the path of least resistance for an American president, whether or not he or she truly believes in a concept or not. It is also the path of least resistance for Christians who would rather be perceived as loyal to the country and its various legends about itself than faithful to God. It seems to me that God cares very little about what country people are from, and even less about nationalism of any stripe. God's litmus test seems to run along the lines of obedience of the heart and not lip service. Israel, the closest this world has ever gotten to a promised land, found itself in exile, captivity, or under foreign occupation for much of its ancient history. If anything, being the promised land, or what we blithely call a Christian nation, is an invitation to be held to a higher standard in the world. Clinging to exceptionalism brings greater scrutiny and judgment, not less. But according to the heresy of American exceptionalism, we are a law unto ourselves. No one has a right to judge us as long as we have our God, our Constitution, and our guns. I've been a Christian since the spring of 1979, And I'm no closer to understanding now than I did then, during my first days in the faith, why so many Christians buy into this myth when it clearly sucks the life out of the church's prophetic critique of this country and its worst practices. And even if you sincerely believe we are a Christian nation, a more refined and high-tech version of ancient Israel, that's all the more reason why this country needs a more robust prophetic tradition in our churches. Can you imagine living in ancient Israel with all of its problems, without scores of ill-mannered prophets constantly calling it to repentance and reformation over hundreds of years, beginning with Moses and Joshua and ending with John the Baptist and Jesus? It would have been unthinkable. Yet somehow, our nation of 350 million, with a history rich in both heroism and criminality, clings to myths of infallibility and blessedness that seem little more than extensions of fables we learned in grade school about George Washington never telling lies. It is an insult to both our intelligence and spiritual integrity to believe in as hackneyed a concept as American exceptionalism, which is little more than a disguise for one's allegiance to Baal. It may be patriotic, but it has nothing to do with God and everything to do with conforming to the world. But as Jesus said in an unusually frank assessment of the powers and principalities of his day, there was nothing Israel enjoyed more than killing its prophets. All the prophets, every single one of them, mocked the idea that Israel was beyond criticism or exceptional, which is why, with very few exceptions, they were all killed for their trouble. They were considered the opposite of patriots. What's interesting about the prophets is that they were compelled to criticize their country and its rulers, even though God was literally believed to reside in the temple. We're very open about being idolatrous and uncritical when it comes to America. Even though this country has lost more wars in the last 50 years than won them, in the win column, we have Grenada, we have Panama, we have the Gulf War. In the loss column, we have Korea, we have Vietnam, we have Iraq, we have Afghanistan. We continue to imagine ourselves unbeatable when we've already been beaten and sold into slavery. I spent more time than I should carping about what I consider one of the biggest obstacles to a vital church life in this country without spending enough time explaining what a politics of prophetic resistance would look like, in my humble opinion. That's because what I imagine churches should be doing is so radical and strange compared to today's compromises that it's difficult to put into words. First, let me just say, I think following the mainline liberal Protestant party line or retreating into a conservative evangelical counterculture would be a mistake. I think Christians are called to be a peculiar people. I think we're to challenge the status quo as it currently exists in our churches and in our society. There are obvious places to start. Racial reconciliation aimed at obliterating all white and black churches as an affront to God, Racial reconciliation aimed at obliterating all white and all black churches as the affront to God that they are would be something the 90% of churches in America that aren't integrated could do right now. This means reaching out in radical Christian love to the other, even when it feels impractical and uncomfortable. Pulpit exchanges, busing 50 or so congregants at a time to urban churches, and vice versa, once a month, enforcing the issue would be a tactic that would have immediate results, mostly good. Once Christians of different backgrounds get to know each other, our politics will change and deepen. Opening a church's door to people who have a different understanding of hot-button issues is guaranteed to make church a more interesting and challenging place. Who says that a church has to change its theology to be a place of welcome to those hurting in a community? Church should be a refuge even for the godless if they choose to be there. Right now, churches value order over the chaos of disagreement. I think we have that backwards. Once we get past the liturgy and into the coffee hour, the gloves should come off, and Christians should be willing to engage in a radical practice of telling the truth and humbly listening when we don't understand something, which probably means being quiet most of the time and doing a lot of head shaking. That's redemptive. I don't think the Christian church in America can afford another decade of being thought of as docile foot soldiers for either the GOP or the Democratic Party. I think we should interrogate our deepest assumptions about culture and politics and strive to be as strange as Jesus and the prophets would have been if confronted by the issues before us. When it comes to issues of war and peace, we know what the Lord requires of us, and it isn't something that's going to make us popular. Ditto when it comes to issues of justice and economic fairness. In fact, Jesus said that we should expect persecution for following him. If we're not being persecuted, we should have the courage to ask ourselves what it takes to be mistaken for a follower of Christ. Meanwhile, I think it must be said that Christians of good conscience can be on opposite sides of the big issues, but what we can't be is indifferent to the big issues. We can no longer afford the status quo in this country that has compelled the church to be a second-rate institution out of fear, instead of being a vital, organic force for change and radical engagement in our society. We have to get beyond our beautiful worship spaces and stained glass windows and take the chances God intended us to take from the day we first believed. Thanks a lot, folks. I don't know what time it is. Short on specifics about how to turn things around, but I think a possible jumping off point for discussion. I guess what I'm asking for in the end is a willingness on the part of my church, your church, every church, to engage in an pre-programmed way discussions with its communities and with neighboring communities, and opening the doors and being open to very uncomfortable interactions, because I think that's the heart of like the gospel life. I mean, when you read the gospels, it's amazing that, you know, Jesus is always in uncomfortable situations. Someone's demon-possessed, or someone needs to be cured of some disease or some affliction, or he's being challenged about his interpretation, you know, of Scripture. And when you read scriptures, when you read about the first century Christians, you know, everything is active. It's an active verb. It is not about contemplation. It is not about just sort of like getting along. And I think what's often missing from churches is the willingness to be a part of rudeness, to be a part of like, you know, the uncomfortable discussion that exasperates people. And I think that once people realize that church isn't boring, that church is where you go to actually have an honest discussion about what's happening in the world and what's happening in your country, I think things will turn around for us. So any comments about that? Anyone want to push back? Yes, sir.
One of the models that has afflicted me for a long, long time comes from the third chapter of Revelation. As a 40-year member of Westminster, I read the passage about the message to the church of Laodicea.
Right.
This is the message from God, I paraphrase. I know you're neither hot nor cold, how I wish you were either one or the other, but because you're lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. You say I'm rich and well off, I have all I need, but you don't know how miserable and pitiful you are. You're poor, naked, and blind. I advise you then to buy gold from me, pure gold, me God, in order to be rich. Buy also white clothing, etc. But he really says, come to me and be active, as you're saying. That really has spoken to me over a long, long period of time. It's right. Not a matter of being comfortable. It is a matter of reaching out. Love one another. I remember the billboard on Banksville Road, the black billboard. Love one another. That's not a suggestion. God.
Right. I became a Christian while at art school, and I remember, it was the Easter season of 1979, and I think it was only like the second year that the Franco Zeffirelli series Jesus of Nazareth had been on TV, and I remember, watching it in the common dorm room. This is the California Institute of the Arts in Los Angeles, and I remember watching it with. We were all non-Christians at the time, but I was obviously going to become one in just a few days. And I remember thinking, if I become a Christian, there's going to be so much I have to give up. And I was reading C.S. Lewis. We had some C.S. Lewis books in the library, and I was reading... Francis Schaeffer had this new book that had just come out called How Shall We Then Live, I think it was called. And I remember reading all this stuff and realizing that, you know, being a Christian would generate a cost. And I remember just walking out into the desert, you know, into Valencia, which was a desert at the time. Now it's, you know, multi-million-dollar homes, but just walking around the desert, you know, surrounding my campus, and just thinking, you know, if I become this Christian, you know, it's just going to change everything, and I just don't know if I can do that. And then at the end of it, you know, and as we approached my birthday, I thought, okay, I guess just like, you know, just like that, I'm just gonna pay the price. And I think since then, you know, being a Christian, I realize it always exacts a price and it's a toll that is inescapable. But I don't really hear that ethic so much, and at least maybe the churches that I attend, you know, they never really talk about the fact that this is going to be something that's going to put you out, that's going to make you uncomfortable, that's going to inconvenience you. And I think that we need to sort of get back to that reality. It's going to really inconvenience you to be a Christian. And maybe the numbers will go down in terms of who is a Christian. And that's a good thing, because I think this inflated number that we have about how many people are Christians in this country, it's baloney. I can't say crap, can I? It is unbelievable. It is untrue. I think that's the safe word.
Patriotism is very important. We should all be patriotic. But if we get to the point of this exceptionalism you described, that's sort of idolatry.
Yes.
And this is what gets us into war. If we think that God's on our side, why are we going to negotiate peace with the devil?
Right.
Why ever negotiate and try to find peace? To do that, you have to believe that humanity is a higher principle than patriotism.
Right.
And that's Obama's problem. He's a peacemaker.
He's a peacemaker. He's very nuanced, and he can be a bit of a cold fish. You know, he doesn't really bring people into a discussion about he clearly articulates what he believes, but he assumes that we're all smart enough to follow along, and he doesn't break it down. And I think this is the one nice thing I'll say about Ronald Reagan. He knew how to break things down for people. He knew how to make people understand where he was coming from. Now, a lot of things he said was nonsense, but he brought people along so that they understood it and that they felt they were invested. And I think this president can certainly learn some communication skills from previous presidents, and maybe he can be a little more humble himself in sort of explaining where he's coming from so that people don't assume the worst about him. I think that this is a good man. I think his theology is smart. I think he's the most sophisticated Christian to ever walk in the White House. But you wouldn't know it from our community, from the community of Christians. He's treated like, he's the Antichrist, literally. And that's appalling, and that's a sign of our own sort of spiritual disease and discomfort.
I'd like to take on your comments about American exceptionalism in this way. I don't think you disagree with the statement that America is exceptional. I think I heard you say that there are many examples wherein you found God working through our country. I think what you're hung up about is the people who take exceptionalism as a form of entitlement, the same kind of self-orientation that we find all through the Old Testament, where the Jews said, hey, baby, we're the chosen people, with all that goes along with that. I think we are truly exceptional and blessed. Unfortunately, I don't think we've heard the call that calls us to take that on humbly and understand it as a burden we must wear, that we must carry, rather than some kind of title that we get.
That's an interesting distinction. I'm halfway there with you on that. I guess I would say that existentially speaking, the United States, we benefit from so many things that other countries clearly didn't have. I mean, our separation from Europe, our separation from many zones of conflict, just the environment of the United States. I mean, self-contained, the resources here, and the fact that we were open to immigration in a way that we got the best and the brightest from some. I mean, in many ways, we benefit from just sort of being in the center of the world, just away from all the nonsense. And so that has led to, a blessedness, if that's the word we want to use. But I think we've taken that, so we've transformed that into an ism. This is proof that God loves us more than everyone else. When in fact, you know, how we got here, you know, there was, you know, the westward expansion, you know, like the, you know, what happened to the Native Americans. I mean, there's like a whole bunch of crimes that accompanied our blessings that we are not open to even thinking about. I mean, we rarely think about that or wrestle with that. I mean, with the question of genocide, set aside slavery and oppression of you know, of peoples. But, you know, yes, so we were born, like that joke says, you know, like George Bush was born on third base and he thought he hit a triple. We were born on third base. And so, yeah, so with that comes, you know, a greater responsibility, I think. And it's you know, a lot of folks don't want to hear that. They say, well, we worked for everything we got. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I hear that from people. You know, you believe in redistributing wealth and so forth? Well, I don't. You know, but I worked for everything I ever made. And it's always a lie when that person says that. You know, we are all the product of our loving parents, you know, who had resources, or maybe in some cases didn't have a whole lot of resources, but certainly loved us enough, pointed us in the right direction, or someone did, and someone helped us. I mean, I helped my kids, you helped your kids. You know, my kid needed a car. I had to go out and buy him a car, give him a car. You know, that's what it means to live in this country. You know, our families help us. Our nation helps us. It sees investing in its people as a good thing. If we had been born in other countries, it would be a different philosophy. There are more tyrannies on this planet than democracies. There are more authoritarian governments than democracies. You know, and we are blessed in that sense. But man, you could just as easily have been born in the Central African Republic. And would that mean that you were cursed? No. You know, it's you know, we don't understand what God's plan is. So we should just be humble about it. Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate very much that you are challenging us, and I'm sure in some ways what you said has made us uncomfortable, but it's one of the reasons people go to church and think they are Christians, because they go to church.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we also, from our pulpit, get challenges. At least I feel that every week. And I've talked to Jim Gilchrist about that, and he said, but you are listening to what I'm saying. and that's true. I think we come, we're happy, we came, many people, and then leave. I think there's certainly a group in this church that does appreciate what you're saying, because we feel that way too. But we aren't out there doing something about it most of the time.
Well, you know, you are doing something. I think the more folks like yourself who are even just open to the discussion is the beginning of the change that we desperately need. You know, it's. I think most churches are by design complacent, and it isn't like the fault of the people necessarily. It's like church leadership and so forth. They know how to turn things around, and they know that in challenging the congregation in the right way, they're either going to see like a drop in attendance, or they might see an explosion in attendance by people attracted to that. They just have to make a concerted decision to be honest with the people, to say, this is the direction we want to travel in. You know, that we want to bring in the people who actually want to be transformational. In my church, we're having this discussion right now, and it is very uncomfortable. I go to a church that is very counterculture in its style. Most people you see there, I'm in the minority, not because I'm black, but because I don't have tattoos, I don't have rings in my nose and ears and so forth, and all that. So I feel like, you know, the gray man from the 1950s. You know, I'm very staid compared to most people in my church. But we're having a discussion right now about how to be better, how to be transformational on the south side of Pittsburgh, how to be a more welcome and opening place. When we started out as a church, the very first time I went there, half the pews were filled with punk rockers and the other half with people who seemed like they were from, you know, who were derelicts. And it was very smelly and strange and dark, and it was at the Goodwill building, and it was like a very, I was coming off of, you know, 10 years, 11 years, 12 years at the Anglican Church on, you know, Mount Washington, Grace Episcopal. I was coming from a very orderly, right one sort of situation to chaos. And over the years I've been at Hot Metal, the population has changed dramatically. Now it's a lot of college students, a lot of families with kids. People grew up, but all of the harder edges, the punk rockers, the derelicts, the drug addicts, the alcoholics, the people who were really suspect, stopped coming. They're no longer there. It's very staid, very comfortable. The people there, the former punk rockers, now wear suits and are not very interesting. And so we sort of lost our sort of edge. And so we're having a discussion right now about what is Hot Metal. And it's very painful to have this because, you know, the people who have been with us for years and years and years stopped coming and have gone other places. And I think this happens at every church when you have this sort of period of self-reflection. I'm very nostalgic for the old, smelly, dirty, dark, dingy days. But no one else is. And so, you know, so we're having that discussion.
Well, and that is what would have happened to those, what would have happened to those people who left the derelicts and all that? They could be a church on their own, could they not?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, and so that's the question we ask ourselves. Did they leave for other churches? Did they leave to become, you know, their own so little community? We suspect a little of everything. And it's not a matter of just trying to get people. I mean, our numbers are always constant. You always have the same, you know, it's a church where there's like a lot of turnover because of your students, and students graduate and go to grad school in other places or start jobs in other cities and so forth. So we're going to have that turnover. But there was like a population of people who obviously were not going to college, who were just, who were street people or people who were close to, you know, the edge. We don't know where a lot of those people are. And it's a concern to us. Did we do something to turn them off? What was it that made them not want to continue at Hot Metal?
I've heard of Hot Metal. I think it's going well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's doing well. Our numbers are strong. But, you know, sometimes even strong numbers mask a deeper problem.
But do you think that we tend to assume a comfort level when we get to a situation where, well, we've made some changes that are very minor, but we've made some changes.
Yeah.
And now we're different.
Yeah.
Now we're okay.
I know that's our problem as a church, at my particular congregation. That's exactly what we do. We get comfortable with the changes, and we should constantly be churning things, I think. but I might be in a minority. I'm not in leadership at my church because I very conveniently dodge that responsibility whenever it's they try to thrust it upon me because my own schedule at the Post-Gazette makes it difficult for me to say, yes, I can be at such and such a place every Wednesday night because I don't know what's going to happen in terms of what I have to do. But I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm sort of hypocritical in not contributing more to the discussion there and the direction.
I'd like to make a suggestion. I'd like to suggest that maybe your most optimistic view of where those people went from your church would be that they are out there as missionaries.
Yeah.
That they are out there no longer dependent upon a church, but that having been juiced up by being in that church, now they are out there. And I would also suggest that isn't that the right relationship of a member of a church? Not as somebody who has to come here to get his gas tank refilled, but as someone who's getting ready to go out there. And that as we lose members, my hope is that we don't lose them to the devil, that we lose them to mission work.
You know, that's funny you should say that. That is a very good point. I read a book that was important to me about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, by Jacques Ellul, who was a French sociologist and theoretician and Christian. He wrote a book called, and it has a very off-putting title. It's called Christian Anarchy. And he said that that's exactly it. You know, that Christians come to a church and they learn things about the kingdom of God, and they're so energized by it that they go out. That's the natural rhythm of things, that they then have to go out and practice church and practice what they've learned if they've had good teaching, and that they appear lawless in that sense, but they're not. They're very much like doing the Francis of Assisi thing, which is good. Without the church walls, they're still doing what God requires of them.
Do you have a comment on the role of pragmatism in a faithful life?
Yeah, the thing is that everyone's default position is pragmatism. I mean, that's just be honest about it. That is the great temptation to sort of like sink into pragmatism at the exclusion of the radicalism that our faith naturally calls us to. You know, again, we the incongruity of the Gospels and our praxis and the way we operate in the real world is very... When I do my devotions in the morning, I read, Scripture, I am very, very conscious of the fact that, I'm going to just blow it again today because I really can't tell my publisher or my boss or whatever what I really think of this situation or suggestion or an editorial or whatever, because I want to be able to pay my mortgage and I got a new car and I want to pay for that and so forth. And so I'm already caught, and the pragmatism, it's like I always say to my wife when we're fighting, let's be practical, let's be pragmatic about this, let's instead of like really taking a chance. And I think that's pragmatism can be the big enemy, of our life, because it's everyone's default position, whatever their religion, or whatever their, you know, worldview. And it's probably the thing that stops us from being who we truly are. You know, when we see examples of people who do amazing things, you know, in the name of our faith, you know, who go places that you just never would ever dream of going yourselves, or at least I wouldn't. You know, they have thrown pragmatism to the wind. And we think secretly that they're crazy. You know, they're following the prophetic tradition, and that is scary and crazy and not pragmatic. So on the pragmatism scale, I'm still in a very pragmatic camp, just inching my way, hopefully at some point, to being a little more radical than I currently am. I think you had a question?
I wanted to say that I've often asked whether we err as Christians by following the organizational institutions, and especially us Presbyterians.
Yeah.
Doing things decently in order.
right.
And spending so much of our energy on that. And I know there are good checks and balances and to make things healthy, but it saps, we're too pragmatic.
Yeah, I'm from Philadelphia, and so when I became a Christian, and you know, in the summer when I went back to Philadelphia, I joined an Orthodox Presbyterian church of all things. But then I used to also attend 10th Presbyterian Church, which is like the biggest, almost like in the pre-megachurch days. Well, it wasn't really pre-megachurch, but it was very much concerned with order. And I thought, you know, that's what the faith was all about, being an orderly Presbyterian and so forth. And it was only when I... started experiencing other faith traditions and so forth, and Christian faith traditions, that I realized that Presbyterians are probably the most uptight of all the denominations, you know. And I don't understand why, you know, because I think we have the, you know, Presbyterians, in a sense, at least the Presbyterians are more reformed bent. I guess I'm revealing my prejudice here. I think have the richest theology, have the deepest insights into the faith. I think my time at Calvin College was so enriching intellectually and spiritually. That reformed world and life view was, to me, it has not been beat, even though there's nothing like it here in Western Pennsylvania, which is... otherwise, I would probably be attending more of a church like that. There is this, whatever the Presbyterian body, there is this sort of preoccupation with hierarchies and structures and order and all of this that I think gets in the way of this beautiful theology, this beautiful practice. And it's this deep irony in Christian history that probably wherever there is the best theology, there's going to be more chains on it so that it can't be properly expressed. So that's my take just on the whole Presbyterian thing.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for sitting through this.